From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really shouldn't miss. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Coming up, some cab companies along the Canadian border are colluding with U.S. Border Patrol.
When the call comes in, we contact Border Patrol. We say, hey, we got a call. It's going to this location. Here's our ETA to that location.
Well, as you can imagine, civil libertarians are not pleased. Then, only about a dozen miles from where MGM is building a resort casino in Springfield, the town of East Windsor, Connecticut, could get its own gambling facility. And a prime location indeed, says the first selectman.
This has been vacant for about 10 years. It's right off I-91, and that's why they built the cinema here. So it's an ideal site for a casino.
But it's not a done deal yet. And we wrap up today with a visit to the Smith College Art Museum to check out artifacts from Pompeii's forgotten cousin of sorts, Aplantis.
Some of these people poignantly had nothing with them. Others had had some of their most precious possessions, the kind of thing where you had no time and you grabbed whatever you could and tried to flee.
All that and more just ahead on NEPR News Now. Last episode, we brought you a story of reaction in Conway, Massachusetts, to a tornado that ripped through town, causing a lot of damage to buildings, but thankfully little to people. That was not the case in another Franklin County town this past weekend. A fire in Warwick early Saturday morning left a mother and four children dead. Investigators say the fire in the single-family home off a dirt road could have started at a wood stove in the kitchen, and it appears to be accidental. Yesterday, residents turned out to mourn, as New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports.
While authorities have not yet identified the victims of the fire by name, everyone in this small town knows whose house burned down, and many know the family personally. The father, Scott Siago, survived the blaze along with one child, and they were at the Warwick Elementary School yesterday afternoon, along with at least 100 others, a large portion of this town of just 800 residents. State Senate President Stan Rosenberg from Amherst was here, as was State Representative Susanna Whips, who lives in nearby Athol. On her way out, Whips said most of the towns in her district are small, like Warwick, and people really look out for each other.
You have to when you live out here. I mean, we're in a community with virtually no broadband service, so small school. I mean, it's a beautiful place to live. It's a quiet place to live. It's a true village.
Warwick is right at the New Hampshire border, one of several sparsely populated towns with a lot of land in what's called the North Quabbin region. Fire departments from all around show up to help out, as they did Saturday, but the blaze had consumed the house by the time they arrived. Whips said a woman who was inside the school sold the Siagos their home a few years ago. She lives nearby, and she brought pictures over. This family's lost everything, Whips said.
Everybody comes together and everybody's hurting.
One Warwick resident who came out of the school said he worked with Scott Siago on the town's broadband committee. Another was a substitute teacher at the elementary school and knew the kids, but almost no one wanted to speak with the media. David Young, the town coordinator in Warwick, would talk a little. Standing outside the school, after almost everyone left, he said the event was helpful for him. Uplifting.
A lot of people from the community turned out, and we're trying to figure out what to do next. I know the school is pretty well prepared for helping kids through this.
But Young yesterday didn't mention the family by name. He said he can't until the district attorney releases that information. But as an official, he said, he knew the family well. He described the mother, Lucinda Siago, whose name is on the town website, as businesslike, very bright.
Very much on top of things, competent and smart, and member of our Board of Health. She fairly recently completed a RN degree.
Young says he thinks the kids in the family range from ages 6 to 15.
And like their parents, they're just incredibly bright, really, really bright children. And I felt terrible for the surviving child who was here. In our midst, and she held up well by all appearances, but I can't imagine.
Inside the school, after the politicians spoke, Young said people sat around talking to each other. A couple of residents who worked on the broadband committee left early to buy Scott Siago a new cell phone. Where the house stood is now a mound of burned debris with nearby cars licked by flames. There are no hydrants in Warwick. There are fire ponds. Young said that's part of rural life. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
As increasing numbers of migrants are fleeing the United States to apply for asylum in Canada, many are crossing illegally at a popular country road in upstate New York. And to complete the last leg of the journey to the U.S.-Canada border, they're taking a cab. But there's a catch. Some of the cabbies are coordinating with U.S. Border Patrol. Vermont Public Radio's Kathleen Masterson reports.
This taxi dispatch in Plattsburgh, New York, is about 25 miles south of the Canadian border, and it's the last outpost to get a cab. There is a Greyhound bus that stops in town before heading to the official border checkpoint. But for most people who want to apply for asylum in Canada, they can't simply present themselves at a checkpoint. That's because an agreement between the two countries says if an asylum seeker is already in the United States, he or she cannot then apply for asylum in Canada. So many folks are finding their way to Plattsburgh and then calling a cab. But when they call a taxi, someone else is alerted, too.
When the call comes in, we contact Border Patrol. We say, hey, we got a call. It's going to this location. Here's our ETA to that location.
This company owner has asked to remain anonymous because he doesn't want any trouble with authorities. He says he bought the business in October, and the first time he dropped someone off at a rural road that dead ends in the Canadian border.
We took one call there, and then immediately we got a call from Border Patrol and said, hey, this is protocol. And from that point on, we've always followed protocol.
There's no requirement for a cab company to check in with the Border Patrol as to their activities.
Michael Estrella with U.S. Border Patrol in Swanton, Vermont, insists that this, quote, protocol, which was described by several cab companies, has never been required by authorities. All he would say is that U.S. Border Patrol does, quote, get help from the community in various ways. Estrella wouldn't say whether taxi companies are among those community members who call in.
I'm not going to get into a specific persons or person who is contacting us. They're doing it as a service to themselves and the rest of their community.
But James Lyle, director of the Vermont ACLU, says that could have real civil rights implications.
It's not the job of the cabbie to interrogate people or assume anything about those people. It's certainly not their job to do the job of the Border Patrol for them. And they can't be required to do the job of the Border Patrol by the Border Patrol.
Within 100 miles of the border, U.S. Border Patrol can stop people who they have reasonable suspicion are in violation of immigration status. But Lyle says he isn't clear that driving to the border would count as reasonable suspicion.
Well, an awful lot of vehicles go to the border. And courts have said that you can't base reasonable suspicion on a characteristic that would apply to a large number of valid or lawful actions.
Of course, the cab drivers we talk to are taking people to a known illegal crossing location in the middle of the woods. To be clear, if U.S. Border Patrol stops a taxi and the people inside have paperwork showing they are authorized to be in the United States, say they have a tourist visa or perhaps they're in the process of seeking asylum status here, then U.S. Border Patrol cannot detain them. That's even if they're about to walk illegally into Canada. But some asylum seekers don't have legal status in the United States, and they can be arrested by U.S. Border Patrol before they reach Canadian soil. The cab company owner from the beginning of the story says he witnessed such an arrest last week, and it changed his mind about the so-called protocol of alerting authorities. He says he was dropping off a woman from Haiti. Years ago, she had fled to the U.S. seeking political asylum. She has an American son who was born here. But her visa had expired, and before the taxi reached the Canadian border, she was arrested by U.S. Border Patrol. The cab driver says they told him she would likely be deported back to Haiti, and her son would likely be put into foster care in the United States. The cab owner says after witnessing this, now his company's policy is to alert Canadian authorities when it gets a border run request. Then, he said, the passengers can be arrested in Canada and have a shot at applying for asylum there. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
Last week, Connecticut's two federally recognized Native American tribes picked East Windsor as the site of a third casino in the state. The gambling complex would be just 13 miles from the MGM casino that's under construction in Springfield. And that's not an accident. The Mohegan and Mashantucket Pequot tribes are looking to fend off the new competition. New England Public Radio's Henry Epp spoke with the first selectman of East Windsor, Bob Maynard. They met at the site where the new casino would be built, right off I-91.
What we're looking at is a vacant Showcase Cinema Theater. This has been vacant for about 10 years. It's right off I-91, and that's why they built the cinema here. Easy access from many of the regional towns. So it's an ideal site for a casino.
Why do you think a casino here would be a good thing for East Windsor?
Well, it would be a good thing for East Windsor for the tax revenue that we'd receive and also for the jobs that we'd create. But it would also be a great thing for the north central region of Connecticut because it will create, the jobs will also be created in other surrounding towns. Also, north central Connecticut is a place that's really poised to grow. In 2 years, just across the river, there's a walking bridge that goes across the river to Windsor Locks. They're going to put a second rail in there, and there's going to be commuter traffic going from Hartford to Springfield, 12 commuter trains a day at least. And also with the Bradley International Airport, I think in the addition of the casino, north central Connecticut will really start to grow.
Well, this deal did not require a local referendum from voters in East Windsor, just the passage by the select board. There was a competing deal in Windsor Locks, which was not chosen, and that would have required a referendum. Why wasn't a local vote by residents required here?
Well, this Showcase Cinema was zoned for a recreational facility, and it's in a special zone, which is called a highway interchange floating zone, which is zoned for commercial. So really, this is properly zoned for a casino.
Sort of like a strip off the highway, more or less?
Yeah. So really, how a private party can develop their land is not something that really a town can vote on. If you're going to put an addition on your house, residents wouldn't vote on whether you could put an addition on your house. It would be determined by zoning. So this will go through zoning. Any kind of a building permit has to go through zoning and has to be determined to meet the zoning regulations that are in place. So that really, to have a referendum certainly could not be binding, and it might be misleading.
Well, MGM criticized this deal, speaking through a spokesperson on Mass Live, doubting whether it would have passed had it gone to voters. Are you confident that residents in East Windsor would have approved this deal if they had had the chance to vote on it?
Yes, absolutely. We put a proposal in a little over a year ago to have a casino built in the southern part of the town, which it was zoned for agricultural use, and the tribal nations dropped us out because they didn't like that location. And when I was speaking with the town residents at that point, and actually we were intending to have a referendum, all of them said, or most of them said, if you had had it where the vacant Showcase Cinema was, if you proposed that, we would be totally in for it. But since it was in the southern part of the town, they really were against it. So a majority of the people definitely are for the casino here.
Well, the tribes have committed in the agreement with East Windsor to hiring 4% of their workforce from East Windsor. This is a much smaller community in population than Springfield, but by comparison, MGM has committed to hiring 35% city residents in its workforce once the casino is open there. Why did you settle for such a low number in your negotiations for this deal?
As you said, there's only 11,400 residents who live in East Windsor, and of course a lot of them are children, and so it would have been very difficult to find sufficient number of employees to work in the facility. But as I said, we're opening it up to the region. There'll be workers from other surrounding towns. The tribal nations are going to have two job fairs here in East Windsor, and so we're really trying to hire local residents, and it doesn't really have to be confined just to East Windsor.
The tribes have made it pretty clear that this new casino is intended as a buffer against MGM, in part to protect their existing casinos and casino jobs in southern Connecticut. Are you concerned that with possibly two more casinos in this region in a few years, quite close to each other, that the market could become oversaturated and this future development could eventually suffer?
I think that the reason the tribal nations are building, and the state of Connecticut is considering building a casino here, is to save about $70 million of tax revenue that would have gone to the MGM casino. And in a sense, I thank the MGM casino for building a casino in Springfield, because I doubt that a casino would be considered here if they hadn't built that casino in Springfield. On the other hand, I guess demographics would show that a casino in this region is a good idea, because there isn't one really accessible until MGM builds the one in Springfield.
Well, lastly, this isn't a done deal yet. The legislature still needs to sign off on it, and there have been rumblings about possibly opening up the third casino selection process to groups beyond just the tribes. Are you worried about that?
In a sense, that you're right, that to have a casino here in East Windsor requires the state legislature to approve that, and I'm concerned now that the state legislature might not approve that.
Do you feel like this proposal, if it is competing against other groups that aren't the two tribes that have proposed it here, are you confident that this would win out over others?
Well, The tribal nations have an agreement with Connecticut. I think they have exclusive gaming rights in Connecticut. The tribal nations were here before us, and they care about Connecticut. They care about the land. So I think the state legislators should take that into account when they make a decision.
That's Bob Maynard, first selectman of East Windsor, Connecticut, speaking to New England Public Radio's Henry App. In the year 79 AD, the city of Pompeii was destroyed during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Some may be familiar with the ancient site. It's been a tourist destination for over 250 years. Not so familiar? Nearby Aplantis. That's the focus of a new exhibition in Northampton at the Smith College Museum of Art. New England Public Radio's J. Kyle Sullivan reports.
This is the first day that we're open to the public, so you really are our first group to see the exhibition.
It's opening day of the exhibit, and UMass professor Letitia LaFollette has been invited to speak to the crowd about some of the sculptures behind her.
We have four sets of these that are small size.
She's here to offer details behind these artifacts, which give a glimpse into life in ancient Rome during the reign of Emperor Nero in the first century. One such artifact is the marble bust of a woman, who may be the mother of the Roman Empress Poppaea Sabina, Nero's second wife.
She dies under mysterious circumstances in 65. The ancient authors say that actually she was kicked by her husband when she was pregnant, and she died of that. Anyway, we know a great deal about her mother, and this portrait may be of her mother, who committed suicide in 47.
The exhibit at the Smith Art Museum, which opened in early February, focuses on two adjacent Roman archaeological sites, what the museum is calling Villa A and Villa B. A is a massive luxury villa once spread out along the coast of the Bay of Naples, believed to have been owned by the Empress Poppaea. The other, Villa B, an industrial complex, where the remains of 54 individuals had been found presumably sheltering in place to avoid fallout from the eruption.
Which is not a villa at all, but a wine emporium, it's okay, probably where they were waiting for a ship to come to the rescue that never arrived.
Barbara Kellum teaches ancient Roman art and architecture at Smith College. She started coordinating this exhibit back in 2011.
Some of these people poignantly had nothing with them. Others had had some of their most precious possessions, the kind of thing where you had no time and you grabbed whatever you could and tried to flee.
Much like a treasure trove of gold jewelry worn by a young woman found there, pregnant and in her early 20s. The stories this exhibit tells could very well have stayed buried. The more well-known sites of Pompeii and Herculaneum were discovered hundreds of years ago. The digging up of Aplantis only took place in the 1960s and 70s. And in 1984, the Italians ran out of money to continue working and place the artifacts in storage. Kellum says when it came to relics of Vesuvius,
there were so many of them that the Museum of Naples has long been taken up with Pompeii and Herculaneum.
So for decades, fragments and materials preserved from Aplantis sat in storage. It was only until a researcher and his team at the University of Texas started the Aplantis Project in 2006 that much of this work was closely examined. This is the last showing of the exhibit in the U.S., circulated by Kellum's mentor at the University of Michigan with help from Italy's Ministry of Culture. This exhibit offers a range of ancient objects preserved by the eruption, from luxury items like that gold jewelry to household goods like silver spoons and terracotta lamps, giving a spectrum of class and lifestyle in Rome at the time.
This contrast between the very wealthy and then the the poor, I think it's definitely something very relevant to what we see in the world today.
Taylor Anderson is a guest curator at the Mount Holyoke Museum of Art. She was struck by an ornately decorated strongbox that would have been displayed in the main atrium of the Empress's luxury villa.
Up above, there's a couple of dogs, perhaps guard dogs, and a duck. I'm not sure why there's really a duck there. And then in the center, there's a head of a woman as well.
Professor Kellum has an explanation for that. The strongbox is actually her favorite piece in the exhibit, originally fashioned sometime in the 2nd century B.C.
It has a very, very complex locking mechanism that you had to know how to manipulate. It involves revolving that female head that's up on top and shifting other elements on it in just the right sequence in order to unlock the strongbox.
The complexity of the strongbox's design speaks to just how much staying power these artifacts really have. Kellum says a better lock wasn't designed until well into the 18th century. Numerous items in the exhibit such as this are likely to inspire reflections on our shared history, as they did for David Brigham of South Hadley. I found him observing a marble sculpture of what may be a representation of Hercules.
My father was in World War II and talked about, you know, being in Italy and seeing some of this stuff, and it's just a real treasure to be able to be here and see and hear about this history. It's just fascinating.
The Treasures of Aplantis will be on view through August 13th. For New England Public Radio, I'm J. Kyle Sullivan.
Thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really shouldn't miss. The show is produced by listener-funded New England Public Radio. Please give us a rating on iTunes, and while you're there, take a look at the other podcasts from NEPR. You can support these podcasts and all the news and music NEPR delivers to your car, your home, and your phone. Just click the blue Contribute button near the top of the page. Again, thanks for listening. Until next time.